Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to IGN Game Scoop. I'm your host, Damon Hatfield. Joining me this week are Sam Claiborne.
Hey, everybody.
Justin Davis.
Scoop.
And joining us once again, Colin Stevens is back. Showed up a few episodes ago, sitting in for Tina, which he is again this week. He's back, baby. Colin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm always happy to be here.
We got a great show for you this week. There is a new, very kind of obscure 16-bit game that's getting re-released. I'm very happy to hear about it. And speaking of 16-bit re-releases, Sonic Origins is on its way, but not everyone is happy with the way it's handling all of its content. But first, as a little bit of an update, I'm about to cross over the 100-hour mark in Elden Ring.
Jesus Christ, what?
Oh my God.
That's so many hours!
I'm just about
in such a short amount of time. This has only been like, what, 2 weeks that you've like really been getting into it?
I mean, yeah, it's just all I'm playing. And when I'm not parenting, basically just playing Elden
Ring. Like, is this is going to be like, Damon, you don't do a lot of multiplayer game. Like, this is up there for like the game you've played the most ever in terms of hours.
Yeah, it's like Disgaea level of hours.
I guess I forgot about Disgaea, where it's like, well, of course I'm going to go into this belt.
Yep. every item in the game has its own dungeon that you can go into. Anyway, yeah. I'm just about to cross 100 hours in Elden Ring. I'm in the mountaintops of the giants. I recently beat Morgoth the Omen King, and I cheesed the shit out of him. I've just basically been cheesing my way all over the lands between, and it's been great.
I mean, but they cheese you, so it's fine.
I mean, I mean, I have no regrets. I do it. I cheese mercilessly in that game.
No regrets.
Yep, no regrets. So Colin, you've also played a lot of Elden Ring?
Yeah, I've been trying to sort of pace myself with it a little bit because I don't want to get burnt out because I love it so much, you know. And so I played some Kirby in the middle of it and could not play two more different games. And I'm reviewing a game right now that I don't think I can talk about, but I'm playing that right now instead of Elden Ring. But the last thing I did was beat Melania, which people consider to be the hardest boss in the game.
There you go.
And I got super lucky because apparently the update that came like the day after I beat her made her like almost unbeatable.
Yeah, she's harder. Like,
my timing was perfect.
Yeah, I have not attempted her yet. We'll see how that will go. But I had some thoughts I wanted to share. I feel like the discourse about Elden Ring needs to be tweaked slightly because the discourse is all about it's so hard. It's a very, very difficult game. But I think it's more accurate to say it's only difficult compared to other modern games. And if you look at Elden Ring, in a vacuum, just compare it, just think about what it's trying to do. There are so many ways to mediate that difficulty. For instance, someone who, you know, has struggled with these games in the past, am about to cross the 100-hour mark. You can grind, you know, like in RPGs, you can grind levels, grind for runes, you can over-level, return to whatever you're trying to do, and you'll be much stronger. There's plenty of places in the game to do that, and the developers don't seem, you know, they haven't passed any of these out, so they don't seem to have a problem with that. And the interesting thing about that, though, is that it also alleviates one of the biggest frustrations with the game, which is the sense of loss that you feel when you die, when you lose your runes. If you can't get back to wherever you died, you just lose all of your runes. Most games, when you die, you just have to try again. This one, you actually lose the most, like the lifeblood of the game, everything you used to level up and buy items. But if you're over-leveled, then all of a sudden the enemies aren't dropping significant amounts of runes, so you don't care. And it totally frees you of that sense of loss. Mm-hmm. It does.
What level are you at right now?
Oh man, I'd have to look it up. I don't know.
Over 100?
No, not over. I think I'm like 80, 90, around there.
So it's so weird because I never farmed for runes at all. I just sort of played everything I could before progressing with the story. Mm-hmm. And somehow in doing that, I wound up getting to like level 145.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And once you get to a certain point, like it takes so many freaking runes to get to the next level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I'm at the point where I think it's almost 200,000 runes that I need to get to another level. So it's just like, if I lose like 30,000 runes, which would have really upset me like 30 hours ago in the game, it's like, yeah, I can beat like two enemies and get 30,000 runes, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. You reach a point where you don't feel the sting of losing them any longer. And then also, so much of the game, Sam, this is what I wanted to point out to you. Should you give Elden Ring another shot? I think you should think of it a little bit like Symphony of the Night, which you describe. Mm-hmm. It's all about, you know, seeing about how far you can push yourself to find the next save room.
The next save. Yeah.
And that's what the Sights of Grace are in Elden Ring. You know, you're always like, if you have runes you want to keep, you're like, oh, I don't know. I've got 15,000 runes now. Should I keep trying to find the next side of grace, or should I just warp back, to safety? And the game is also, it's very much like that. And like I said, if you're freed of the worry of losing those runes, then you're much more adventurous trying to find the next set of.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Plus you can look up where the next side of grace is. And
exactly.
If you're really stressed out, you can just use a guide.
Exactly. Mm. The other thing is the enemy AI, it's actually not that smart. It's pretty easy. You can stealth, you can sneak. Pretty easy to sneak up on enemies. If you don't walk right in front of their face, they're not going to see you. If you get behind enemies, you can do a backstab, which isn't always a one-hit kill, but it will take away a huge chunk of their life. It's super easy to do. And that also means that if there's like a tough group of enemies, you can probably just run past them. Like, you don't have to you don't have to engage. You can just run past them. And the cool thing is that when you die, you only lose your runes. You don't lose any items. So if you're like, if I'm in a dungeon and there's a room with an item in it and some tough enemies, I just like run in as fast as I can, pick up all the items, and then say, fuck you. Who cares if I die? I keep all my items.
Yep. That was the same way. Like, I am not playing Elden Ring, but that's the way I was playing it. It's like just ignoring a lot of enemies and running around, scooping up as many items as I could.
Yep. You get to keep all those.
Yeah, they have this thing called the flask of curious physic or something like that. The thing that you can like combine tiers into.
Yep.
And I found a tier that gives me like the sacrificial twig effect, which makes it so if I take that potion and I die, I don't lose any runes within like a 2-minute window.
Yeah.
So like if I ever go into an area that I'm just like, I might die here. I just take a twig and I'm good. It's beautiful. And something that I found out, if you had died previously, and you take that swig and you die after you took that swig, and like say you just had 0 runes, you'll still have 0 runes. You can still pick up all the runes you lost like 2 lives ago.
Oh, interesting.
So like it's like very forgiving if you can find that.
That's cool. It's a good tip. And then Colin, do you know about the poison mist spell? Have you used that?
So I am like purely melee in this game, which I've never done before in a Souls game, but I ended up just really liking it. Mm. So I'm aware of it, but I do not have the faith to use it or whatever I need.
I was mostly melee until I heard how you could use poison mist to cheese so many enemies in the game. I post about this in the Facebook group. Like any enemy that's standing still that doesn't have like a route they're patrolling, you can sneak behind them. I've tried on many enemies. I've tried it on bosses. And major bosses, and it's worked. They do not react to you casting this poison spell, and they don't react as they start losing hit points. So they'll just stand there until they just fall over dead. And it may take a while.
That's like a bug? Do you think that's like designed?
For what
I think,
reason?
So here's my thoughts on like AI design in all of these games. I think they're intentionally extremely video gamey and extremely predictable. So because the game knows it's hard. It knows that it'll kill you like in just a couple hits, even with like some kind of lower level enemies. Yeah. But like it makes it so if you are redoing the same things over and over again, it's not super frustrating because you can sort of predict what will and will not happen. And so like I think it fully anticipates you cheesing stuff like this all the time. Like and that's not coming from someone who's just like FromSoft does no wrong. There's nothing wrong with any of their design philosophy. It's all perfect. But I do genuinely think that stuff like that is like intentional.
Well, I appreciate it. I use it whenever I can. There's like all these, you know, sort of gated areas where there's a boss just sort of waiting for you to arrive before you can progress. But if they're not moving, I can just sneak up behind them and just start casting poison spell, wait 20 minutes maybe, and they'll eventually feel over dead.
20 minutes?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's really fun. That's why he's played 100 hours. I think it's really funny how all those bosses are sitting there just waiting calmly, peacefully. Yeah. They're just waiting to kill you specifically.
That's their only purpose. Yep.
Yeah, nothing ever fights each other in that game. Huh?
There's like a little bit. You will sometimes see like crabs fighting other stuff. But
it's a monster fighting human things.
But I just like they know like sometimes though, Damon, it's comedic. Like sometimes they do the opposite of what you're describing, where you cast poison on them till they die. Sometimes it's like you enter their area from like a half mile away, and then they immediately turn around and beeline. They're like, here we go.
Yeah. There's been a couple like that too. Anyway, that's my Elden Ring update. Sam, is it true you beat unpacking?
Yeah, but that's not easy. It's not difficult to do.
You moved in.
Yeah, I didn't know that was a game you could beat.
Yeah, there's an ending, and there's even like a old school video game ending where like it shows like a little scene. That's all you get, aside from the satisfaction that you put all your coffee cups in a place that you're really proud of, and that makes a lot of logical sense if you're going to make coffee. And the game doesn't let you get too illogical. So do you know this game concept at all?
I know the concept, but I guess I didn't realize. There was even, how do you fail? What's the fail state of this game?
There's no way to fail. You only fail by, putting your toilet paper under the wrong sink. And then it's like, no, you can't do that.
There's also little Easter eggs for putting stuff. Like all the game's achievements are like, if you put something in a logical place, like you put all your cookie jars on the top, like on the very top shelf of your kitchen, because that's where cookie jars go. Like that's the game's achievements, but it never like tells you that.
It calls it like a sometimes snack is the name of that achievement. Or if you put your hair curler in the shower and set it down for a second, it will tell you that, you won like a life risking achievement. So like the basic concept of the game is that you start, in these different, it's one person and you're unpacking stuff from like a kid through adulthood. And so like the cool like toy story aspect of it is that see these things show up over and over again, right? And so and then the game progressively tells a story in a passive way that's extremely smart, and it's just like it's totally worth doing. And then the reason I'm playing this game, by the way, I also just started Spiritfarer, and I'm actually completely hooked in that game. I did these end to end is because I'm watching so much TV right now, I cannot get back into Elden Ring. I just don't have the time. So I need to play things that like I have 20 minutes, 30 minutes for, because I'm trying to keep up on all these contemporary shows, and they're bad shows too. Like, like Picard, like I have to watch every Star Trek. I'm compelled to, but like the season's not going great. And Halo, like I love Halo too, like crazy, but I have to watch it. So there's that stuff on top of the shows that I want to watch. So that's basically like my gameplay right now is keeping up on all the sci-fi stuff. I will say Our Flag Means Death is amazing.
Okay.
Do you know what that is?
I've just heard the name.
It's Taika Waititi's, and then it's his cast of the kind of cast of comedians from What We Do in the Shadows. It's basically you recognize so many people in it. Like it's like it's that mindset and that type of humor about pirates. And it's like cool. I think it's mid season or just finished its season on HBO, but it's so good to start it right now because like you need to watch a couple episodes, it's better to watch it back to back. And then there's like a little bit of a twist. And then, like, the cast is really good after that. There's, like, an introductory character. Anyway, digression. Unpacking, super cool, recommend it. And you can play it in these little sections, and it tells a story.
They do. I played Unpacking, I think, in one sitting and loved it. I don't know if I ever talked about it on GameScoop. It's, like, 3 hours long.
One so
it's like
sitting? Your brain must have been, like, putting so many things into invisible containers as you fell asleep that night.
It was a very stressful time, and the game is perfect for that. Like, but, like Sam alluded to, it's one person from the time they're a kid to the time, all the way through their life, each time they're moving into a new place. So you see them move into their first, really, really crappy college dorm, and then like their first apartment, and then like you see them progress and unpack all their stuff, and then the story takes some interesting turns based off how they're moving and what they're doing. But one really cute thing is they have a little teddy bear that like follows them, like they take it with them everywhere through their whole life, and it gets like rattier and older as they go. And then you always have to figure out like where in their life, like they're clearly middle-aged now, like where do they want to put this sentimental teddy bear that's like important to them? And and sometimes you have to make like tough choices, like, ooh, maybe it goes under the bed. I don't know. Like, I don't know where to put it anymore. But it's very fun. It's very open-ended. You can't fail. So it's like, it's just satisfying. Like when you're unpacking their like kid room, Like, where do I want to put all their action figures and, you know, stuff like that. It's really cute and well done. And like, they unpack newer and more modern game consoles as the game goes on. So it does.
Cool.
It does really clever stuff like that, too.
It's actually set in years. So it's like, it goes, I don't know, it's like 2003, 2006, and then 2011. And the person in the game is like a few years off from me, but like overlaps with my college years, overlaps with, you know, like, you know, it's like not spot on, but it's close. So it's really cool because you start out with a GameCube, and it's like a GameCube, and the box art, you can recognize the, it's pixelated. It's like all, you know, fake retro graphics, or retro style graphics, I should say. And so you can like see like Wind Waker when you like pick up the game, and you can see the GameCube art a little bit, and you know, it's all a little bit off. So you go through that, and then you get a Wii, and the character only gets like, I think it's like one or two Wii games, but then they keep all of the GameCube games, you know, which is like, it's just like a really funny, relatable thing. It's like, you can see Wii Sports, and then like nothing else, you know, and then like there's like all these Blu-rays eventually. It's really funny. So there's little twists like that.
Cool. Did you play Unpacking on PC?
No, I'm playing it on Game Pass, which makes it super easy. Cool. So that's the thing.
That's great.
So I should have prefaced with that. The reason I'm doing this like bubblegum gaming right now is because I grabbed that. I grabbed Spiritfarer. I grabbed Halo Wars 2, all just because they're just like, that you just load them on Game Pass in like 1 minute and then they're just there. I got a few others too that I'm thinking about trying, but that's like kind of my order right now. I'm going to go through Spiritfarer, then I'm going to try Halo Wars 2. So yeah, I'm excited to kind of plumb the depths of smaller games on Game Pass.
Yeah, that's cool. I didn't know that was on Game Pass. That sounds great.
Yeah, it's nice.
And Justin, what's the Lego update?
I finished Lego Harry Potter, and now I'm on to Lego Star Wars 3, The Clone Wars.
Oh, wow.
So, like, there's these Lego games that have, like, these different milestones, right? Like, Lego Harry Potter is the first one that has, like, a hub world in it, and Lego Batman is the first one that's not, like, parodying an established movie. It's telling its own story. And, like, the thing about Lego Clone Wars is that's the first Lego game that I didn't know. I've never seen it. I don't know anything about it. I don't even think I knew it existed. I mean, I don't know. If, I suppose if someone were to ask me, like, hey, did they make a Lego game based off Clone Wars? I'd be like, yeah, I guess they did. But, like, this is the first one I'm going into, like, completely blind. Mm-hmm. It's been good so far, but this is also the first and probably only Lego game where I don't know. I haven't seen the source material.
Yeah.
Cause like I've seen Hobbit, I've seen Lord of the Rings, I've seen all the rest of them. And so it's like, you know, it's like there's this silly stuff happening and I'm like, I don't have any connection to any of this.
It's canon though. I mean, not the Lego game, but the show is. Yeah. So maybe I'll just put some stuff that like is going to be like suddenly in a live action show that you're watching. You're like, oh yeah, that's from Clone Wars. Cause I hear that happens a lot if you don't watch that series.
Yeah, definitely. Especially now with like Mandalorian and all that stuff coming back.
Sam, have you watched Clone Wars?
I've watched some of Clone Wars. Mostly I watched early on. There was like a movie that came out, you know, in conjunction with it. So I watched the first couple seasons, but I never watched Rebels. So that's the one I haven't seen all. I haven't seen any of Bad Batch. But yeah, I did watch the there's a Jabba the Hutt. Well, there's a Hutling. Named Stinky. That's what the movie's about. I thought it was pretty fun.
I hear some of the Clone Wars is good. I can't get behind the art style.
I know.
I tried watching it front to back, and like it starts off really bad.
Really?
Like pretty low quality stuff. But I looked up an abridged like watch order. And I recommend doing that because there's actually some really good stuff in there.
Yeah.
And if you do those, they'll basically tell you like which ones to do, so you make sure you get like the Darth Maul arc and stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
And so that's worth it.
You gotta do.
It's a show with a lot of filler, so if you can get away from the filler, it's great.
And like I've tried watching Clone Wars several times, and I have a sickness where I can't skip filler. I just have to. Even in anime, like I have to watch all the filler. But like Clone Wars is like. It's the one, except like it's a kid's show, right? Mm-hmm. So you're going to watch some episode about some crappy kid that like, and I would be sitting in my basement on my giant TV watching some kid's cartoon with some kid's plot. And I'm like, what am I doing? But if you actually watch like, you know, the arcs and like, you know, the stuff that is more serialized, like then it's the one time they make an exception to my, you know, skip the filler rule.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, getting into this week's news, it's become very common for even fairly obscure retro games to get re-releases now, but one game I did not expect to hear was getting re-released this week is Zero Tolerance, the 1994 Sega Genesis first-person shooter, getting re-released this week as the Zero Tolerance Collection, which is funny because as far as I know, there was only ever one Zero Tolerance. The collection is going to include the original game, which we're seeing here. This is a first-person shooter Doom clone running on Sega Genesis. As a Doom clone, no, it's not that spectacular, but it does run pretty well, I think, surprisingly well on the Sega Genesis. And I believe I've mentioned this game before because this game is very gory and it's awesome. It has awesome pixelated gore, blood that splatters on the walls and slides down, and it looks really chunky like guts, and I love it. It's great. That's why I recommend this game. But it includes the original and then something called Zero Tolerance Underground, and then the prototype of the sequel that was never released called Beyond Zero Tolerance. That I get. The original, prototype of the sequel. I don't know what Zero Tolerance Underground is. I can't find any reference to it online. But it's in this game. Three Zero Tolerance games.
Wow. Yeah, the Genesis is really working hard in this game. It doesn't look bad. It holds up pretty well, too. I love this. I played Super Nintendo Doom a lot, and the Jurassic Park is a Doom clone on it, which is fantastic. I love that game. And even though it's like janky, it's like Zelda mashed up with Doom. Like it's a really interesting game. But I've never played the series at all, nor did I think to rent it. If I would have known at the time that it was Doom, like I would have, because I played like every game like that. So just completely. How did you play it? You rented it at the time?
I didn't play it at the time. I played it, recently, just through via emulation.
I don't know how available that game was in the United States at the time, but I'll have to look at that.
Yeah. Well, Alan, if you could bring up the footage again one more time. I think the only reason it runs as well as it does is because the actual play field is so small on the screen.
That's what I was going to say. It's like, it's so crazy.
Force the resolution to be smaller. It's easier.
Yeah.
This is a deathmatch mode, though.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing.
Or maybe, I guess it might be cooperative for all I know. I'm not really sure.
Look at how the game itself is like.
It's like, it's basically like when you're driving, it's the rearview mirror, compared to your windshield.
And TVs were already 13 inches back then. Like the game is an inch and a half tall.
And it works. I love the wide aspect.
They just have this guy's driver's license or whatever the hell this
Captain,
is.
Well, they always had to find that filler
information.
Yeah. Well, I know you're totally right. Like all the games that had that always had like a funny heads up filler area. And they just had to do that. The map looks great here though. Like look how much the map's working hard too.
Yeah.
Like real time updates of the dots. Like that's a whole separate. I don't know. It's a cool little engine we're seeing here for the Genesis.
Well, in case anyone was wondering if Zero Tolerance Collection is worth picking up, I have the Electronic Gaming Monthly review from 1994. This is from September. They gave it a 9, a 6, a 7, and an 8. So pretty good.
Wow.
I'll read the 9 score. For those of you who can't get enough Wolfenstein and Doom, Accolade has got a new first-person game that's sure to test your mettle. Zero Tolerance surprisingly scrolls smoothly and plays great. At times, the enemy can get pretty cheap. The levels are huge, and I like all the weapons you can pick up. Overall, Zero Tolerance is a fast-paced shooter that shines particularly well on the Sega Genesis. Then at the other end, the low score, the 6, said Zero Tolerance is one of the most violent games I have ever played. The gore, blood, and carnage throughout the levels are excellent. It's great. Sorry, the text is very small. It's great tagging every enemy in sight with all the cool weapons. As a one-player game, it's great. I just don't care for the two-player simultaneous game. Maybe it's because I want to do all the killing. So I guess it is cooperative. Capping my partner was fun sometimes. Maybe not. The control also needs weeding out. That's a 6.
That's like really glowing praise, actually. That's a really high scoring.
It doesn't match up to me.
Yeah.
You do have to imagine playing this on that chonky Genesis controller and how much that would contribute to the pain of this game. Three buttons. They had to make games 3 buttons, even though they had the 6 button.
Did you pick up on how that game, like the deathmatch hadn't entered the nomenclature yet?
I guess
for like game critics, like the two-player mode, like it's just funny.
Yeah. Anyway, Zero Tolerance Collection is coming sometime this year for everything. It's even coming to PS5 and Xbox Series X. So looking forward to those.
Whether you like it or not,
chunky, bloody pixels sliding down walls on my PS5.
I want every game described that way.
Chunky, bloody pixels.
No, Lego Skywalker Saga is coming to Switch, whether you like it or not. It's like, what are you talking about?
Let's check in with the listeners.
Hey, listeners.
Oh, hey.
Listeners, remember, you can always reach us at the email address, gamescoop@IGN.com, just like Overlord of the Superfans, Matt Jones, did. Matt writes in to say, I'm a 2D...
Is that a self-described title?
I knighted him that title many, many years ago.
Yeah, he's been writing in almost as long, maybe longer than Big Tony style.
Yeah, he's the original Gamescoop superfan.
Why don't you pause before his name?
It's just that's not how you pronounce his name.
Okay.
Yeah, Big Tony style. His name actually just has 10 spaces in front of it. So that's you have
how
to.
That's how
ellipsis, it's Big Tony style.
Matt says, I'm a 2D Sonic fan. I love Sonics 1 through 3. I think Sonic Mania was an incredible continuation of that tradition. So when Sonic Origins was announced, I was super excited. Then they released the trailer, and I was even more excited. Hearing that some of the people who helped make Sonic Mania took the lead on these remasters was great. And then they revealed the whole DLC situation. Pretty much all the DLC is stuff that should 100% be included in the main game. Additional Genesis music, camera controls in the main menu, letterbox backgrounds, all those things for $5 or a pre-order bonus. Ridiculous. Sonic has a lot of goodwill from two pretty good movies in Sonic Mania recently, so I don't know what they were thinking with this move. It's an interesting and very confusing situation. Like, it's whether or not you think like the way they're handling it is like, you know, greedy or unfair. It's confused. It shouldn't be confusing knowing how to get all the content in the game.
Yeah. Right. It's just stupid. Like, it's so silly to me that it's $5. It's like they had to make this giant matrix of like what comes in what edition just to sell the game for $40 and then sell like a fancier version of the game for $45. It's like, just charge $45 and put that stuff in the game. Like, why the amount of work that they made for themselves just to sell a $5 version of the game. Yeah. There it is. It's so like, I don't even necessarily have an opinion on like, you know, whatever, like deluxe editions of games have existed, you know, for over a decade now. I'm just so baffled by the fact that it's $5 more.
But they use little rings to mark the chart.
I know. There should be one version that comes with all the rings. Yeah, nothing has all the rings.
For those that are listening that can't see this, there's an infographic that Sega released that we're showing on the show. You can check it out on IGN or YouTube. And it's a complex little table that shows what's in everything. But the best part about it is that if you get the deluxe edition that you pay more for, it doesn't come with everything. To get everything, you also have to, I believe, pre-order it. Is that correct?
Yeah, I guess if you pre-order the digital deluxe edition.
Yeah,
that's the only way to get everything.
But if you buy the digital deluxe edition after, you won't get 100 bonus coins, whatever that means, mirror mode, or letterbox backgrounds.
Yeah.
Background.
Yeah. Background. Yeah.
Which is important. It's a Sonic's license in the lower right corner.
I think I'm going to buy this, though. Like, I'm on record. I'm afraid to even bring up Sonic the Hedgehog on this show because they come after me once a year or so. I'm a known Sonic hater, but the truth is that I grew up with the Genesis. I was a Genesis kid growing up. I was not a Super Nintendo kid growing up. And so, like, that music and the visuals, like, that triggers much deeper nostalgia for me than, like, you know, than Super Mario World does, if I'm being honest. And so, I haven't played these games, you know, in a long, long time. And, you know, I watch both the movies with my kids and they're really cute. So I don't know. Like, I think I'm going to buy it for $40 for, you know, four classics. Let's go. I'm on board.
So it's the first, it's Sonic's 1, 2, and 3, and then Sonic CD.
Sonic 3 and Knuckles and Sonic CD. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there's another 8 pieces of content that are not included in the standard edition. They're just spread across all these different editions. The craziest thing to me is that one of the things that's locked behind this premium fun pack that I guess is $5 is character animation in the main menu.
I was hoping you'd bring that up. It's so stupid.
What? So just like, if you don't pay extra, I'm trying to think, the main menu is just like, it's usually just a big Sonic, right? with his like.
Well, there's probably a overall menu screen.
Right.
So. My other favorite one was the music visualizer. Like in the soundtrack mode, the characters only animate if you buy the $5 DLC.
Like what? It's so stupid.
Like in my mind, it's just like, you know, honestly, sell one version of this game, make it $45, yeah, put sure. everything in it.
Sure.
I like pro consumer, like being able to give them like a cheaper option. But like Justin was saying, it's like $4 or $5. Like it's just they made such a big mess out of something that should have been like an absolute easy home run for them.
Well, let me put this into perspective. Sonic the Hedgehog 4 came out as an episodic game.
I know. Yeah. Oh, my God. On phones, right? It was a mobile game.
No, it was on everything. And I wouldn't recommend playing on phones. I think I reviewed it too. This is
really
one of those Damon moments. That's what we're calling them.
Oh, I did that recently with I was doing research for my Lego project, and I reviewed Lego Harry Potter 2 for IGN, and I'm like, A, I don't remember reviewing that game, but B, and scarier, I don't even remember playing that game.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I did. Like, well, I remember. So I remember testing the PS Vita version and just I remember doing that. Like, that's my memory. And like, but clearly I played through the whole game on like Xbox or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I played Sonic 4 and probably Wii or something. That's also like, you know, why exclude that? Why exclude color? I don't get this stuff, man. Like Sonic 1, 2 and 3, you can play it anywhere. You can buy like the worst Sega Genesis off the shelf thing. Remember that one that you got, Damon? The
at games one.
Yeah, like they all have good versions of Sonic at least on them. And so what I do really like that there's like a widescreen absolutely done in engine, like redone version of this. And it looks like, you know, frame rate will like look really cool and stuff like that. Like that's a cool way to like kind of, you know, redo old games. But like, yeah, it's hard for me to get excited about these. I love these games. I played them so much though. Like I don't know if I want to own them in another way.
Yeah, I'm looking on Steam. The original Sonic games are $5 each on Steam, so you can get those four games for $20.
And I know that CD is not in Genesis collections because it's not a Genesis game, so that's a little bit less accessible, but it's around.
Right? Wait, what are you saying again about
Sonic CD? About?
Oh, okay. The game. Well, I was going to point out that Sega Genesis Classics is an awesome collection, and it's on the PlayStation Spring sale right now. 67% off. It's only $10, and that includes Sonic's 1 and 2. It doesn't have 3 or CD.
I remember. Yeah, it was weird.
But, three. You know, it has, like, almost every other great Sega Genesis game on there. Shining Force 1 and 2.
Yeah.
You know, Streets of Rage 1, 2, 3. Golden Axe 1, 2, 3. Crazy stuff like Crackdown, Comic Zone, Decapitate.
I definitely want to, like, throw this Sonic collection will be fun to like throw on a TV in the office if we ever work in an office together again, right? Because like people will play through them and, you know, they get impossible after level 4, but they're fun. And like maybe it'll have some save states and rewinds and stuff like that to make them more accessible.
Do you see that? Oh, one really cool thing it has is it has this cool mission mode that's like, you know, it's like, you know, beat a level without, but getting fewer than 5 coins or like destroy 5 of this enemy in a level. Like
NES Remix type stuff. I love that. So I can't slag that.
I love it. And then I think, I don't know that this is true, but I think you earn like little coins that let you unlock, you know, the music tracks and little bonuses and stuff like that. So
that's what you need those 100 free coins for.
Yeah.
I think that's true. Yeah. That's rad.
Yeah. They're using coins, even though the game is about rings. I just want to point that out. Different currencies.
Yeah.
Well, Sonic Origins is out June 23rd. And good luck to all Scoop Nation who wants to try and get all the content.
It's hard to see Sega going back on this decision too. We'll see.
Oh, I was actually going to ask that thing too. Yeah.
Like other companies, like EA might change their policy or something, but like Sega of Japan, like, I don't know. It's unlikely.
We'll see.
I could see them saying, we're just going to give you everybody this $5 stuff.
Maybe.
We'll see.
Maybe you have to beat every level on, you know, hard mode and you can unlock it that way. Except you can't play hard mode unless you get this one version.
You know, when it comes to wireless carriers, sometimes what you see isn't always what you get, except with Visible. With Visible, what you see is exactly what you get. If you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. With Visible, there are no hidden fees, no fine print, no hassle, nothing to hide. It's just $25 a month, all taxes and fees included. And you don't need more than one line of wireless to save.
You can save on a line all to yourself with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. And again, just $25 a month. The future of wireless is here, and it is transparent. If you want more transparency in your wireless plan, you want to be on the Visible plan. Switch to Visible today and save at Visible.com. That's Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. This episode of Game Scoop is brought to you by NordVPN. As Scoop Nation knows, your Omega Cops have been a little obsessed with a movie called Weekend at Bernie's lately. But as happens too often these days, it is difficult to find it streaming here in the US. That's where NordVPN comes in. With NordVPN, you can switch your virtual location to a more enlightened region where they appreciate the comic delights of Weekend at Bernie's. And it's not just for streaming movies and shows. Switching your virtual location can allow you to save money by purchasing flights, hotels, and subscriptions from other countries at a cheaper price. And you can do all this worry-free as NordVPN threat protection features protect you from viruses, malware, and phishing sites. Best of all, NordVPN costs the price of a cup of coffee a month, and one account can be used on up to 6 devices. To get the best discount on your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/gamescoop. Our link will also give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. That's nordvpn.com/gamescoop.
This is Mike in Toronto, and he wants to know if you're up for some video game trivia.
I mean, says I know
you like
back
playing
half of this episode.
I mean, we don't really have a choice because we're just here on the show.
Right, yeah.
he says, I notice you like.
Go. See ya. Not ready for some trivia.
He says, I notice you like playing parlor games from time to time on GameScoop, like GameScope, the real mature video games one, yeah, and of course,
starting to sound very supervillain.
Video game 20 questions, but a notable omission is a gaming trivia, probably because it's a chore to come up with the questions yourself. To help lighten Damon's workload, I've come up with 10 gaming trivia questions you might wish to use on the show. Here we go. After Mario and Mega Man, which video game franchise has seen the most entries?
Why? I wouldn't even think Mario and Mega Man would have the most entries.
Yeah, same.
Like King of Fighters, Mega they have Man. 17 of them.
I don't know. I don't know how to answer this. Is this including like non-mainline entries then? So like just real, real deep spin-off stuff?
I've provided all the information I have.
All right, then I'm gonna go with Final Fantasy.
Mike, Donkey Kong.
Mike in Toronto says it's Sonic the Hedgehog.
I was about to say Sonic.
There's a lot of Sonic.
You didn't let me answer.
All right, sorry.
Sorry, Colin.
Make sure everyone gets in there. Okay, in the early
you can just answer the next one. You're by yourself. All right,
fine. The answer is
you gotta get it right then.
Okay. In the early PlayStation classic Jumping Flash, you control what kind of robotic animal?
It could be Sonic the Hedgehog.
Rabbit. I think it's a rabbit.
It is a rabbit. What was the original? Yeah. What was the original pack-in game for the Sega Genesis?
Altered Beast.
Altered Beast. Right.
It was really? Altered Beast.
I did not know that.
In Star Wars, Masters of the Terrace Kasi, just what is the Terrace Kasi?
These are really hard. I know a lot about video games, I think.
I think it's a like an order of powered up people that are not Jedi.
Or maybe I'm going to guess it's a lightsaber fighting style. I'm going to guess that it's just the arena that they fight in.
Justin's closest. It's just the fighting style. It's the fighting style they're using.
Even though it's like a Wookiee up against a Jedi. It's all Terrace Kasi.
Princess Leia. On what date was Sega's Dreamcast released in North America?
9999. Yeah.
9999. I like this question. This is a good one. What game features Sean Connery's final performance as James Bond?
Oh.
It's not James Pond Jr., right?
They had that EA made that. I can picture the game. They had like, it's called like Bond, like Legends or something like that, where they brought back multiple Bonds, right?
I bet it's just GoldenEye because there's like a Sean Connery Bond that you can unlock and play as.
I don't know.
He wouldn't have provided like any sort of voice for that. But apparently 2005's From Russia with Love actually featured Sean Connery.
That's great.
Oh. Yeah. There was a game. I'm looking at it. There was a game called 007 Legends, but it was not at all what I just said. So
it's a Lego game.
It sounds like that. It's a Lego game. What was the final game officially released for the NES in North America?
There's a couple options.
Late NES so Yoshi's Cookie.
Wario's Woods has a game rating on it, so I would say probably that.
It's Wario's Woods.
Yeah!
Couple more. The NES pseudo-classic Faxanadu is the sequel to what Japanese PC original?
First of all, there's some question about the pronunciation of that game now, which I've mentioned on the show before. It could be Faxanadu.
Yeah.
Wait, that's a sequel to a PC RPG.
Japanese PC game.
And let me just ask you one question, Damon. Did you know the name of this Japanese PC game?
I wouldn't have known if I hadn't been prompted, but once you know it, it's very, very obvious what it would be.
Faxana 1.
No, I don't know.
The original, or the game that Faxanadu is a sequel to, is called Xanadu.
I was going to say that!
Ah, I was thinking that too. I was going to make a joke saying like Xanadu 2, like Rosebud or some stupid reference.
I like Faxana 1. But it's also it's fantasy Xanadu. So is the first game not fantasy? I don't get it. Whatever.
I don't know. And then the final question of these three, which character did not appear in PlayStation All-Stars Battle Royale? Crash Bandicoot, Kratos, or Ratchet?
I think Crash.
Crash.
Yeah.
It is Crash. Apparently Crash was not in PlayStation All-Stars Battle Royale. Which is crazy.
Sure, it's just
Crash had gone multi by that point, maybe?
Yeah, he's Activision.
I guess he had gone to Activision, yeah. Anyway, nice.
I'm still upset about the Faxanadu question. I'm just trying out the pronunciation on because I have like, you know, I don't have photographic memory, but I have something like it. And I just saw the Wikipedia page and I can picture reading the facts that I can read off about Faxanadu. And that would have been clearly on that. And I didn't internalize it. Very disappointing.
Okay. This is Max the Frenchman from Sydney, Australia. Long-time listener, first-time writer. Here's a short question, which I hope you will all enjoy discussing. We often talk about what our favorite video games are or who our favorite characters are, but recently I've been wondering what my all-time favorite in-game locations were. By location, I mean a specific place within a game where part of the action or story takes place. It could be a building, a town, or even an entire map area that you thought was either beautiful or well-designed that triggers intense gaming nostalgia for you. For example, I always think fondly of Midgar in the Shinra building, in OG Final Fantasy VII, the mansion in the OG Resident Evil, someplace in Dark Souls, or the Skellig Islands in Witcher 3. All are places that remind me of my past gaming achievements and how amazing video game worlds can be. GameScoop, what are your favorite in-game locations?
I didn't give any thought to this prior to the show. I wish I would have, because I'm ready to go. Go for it.
Okay, so I like castles. I think they're really cool. And so when I there's an obvious one. I think Castlevania 1 specifically has the coolest castles. 2 just has a bunch of mansions. Come on. I mean, it has a castle at the end, but mansions I'm not as into as castles. So Castlevania is really cool. And I love specifically the sense of place that you get because it shows the clock tower in the background on, you know, world, whatever, 3 or 4. You can see it and then you get to it by the end of the game. Love that. And then I really like in Dragon's Lair, that's like a really cartoony, cool kind of Disney castle. That is another one that I just adore. And then one of the other games I wanted to call out, which is weird, that I really like is Goonies 2.
Whoa.
I like Goonies 1 also. They both start in that, the summer restaurant. And then they both go into subterranean levels. And it's awesome. Like, it's just really a cool sense of place. And then that links to my final one, which I know may hopefully spawns other people's memories. But I love the text adventure Zork, and the Underground Empire. And Zork is very near and dear to me. I love it. Described well in text. And then in these funny CD-ROM games later, like Return to Zork, they realized it in graphics. You know, you can kind of compare your memory of it, or, your internal concept of it. But that game is all about like everything's underground, right? So there's like giant environments and huge areas that are like carefully like carved into the sides of caves. And then you're in very dark areas and very beautiful areas. And I just love it. I think it's the coolest setting. Did I do good? Did I answer the question?
Yeah, that was great.
Okay.
Colin? I really love the beginning sections in Zelda games, specifically like 3D Zelda games. Mm-hmm. They're very like age of innocency, very like pastoral, very much like you're just sort of a kid before you go off on this big adventure, you know, and there's just something very like quaint and calming to all of it, like Kakariko Village and Ocarina of Time. But I think my favorite is Outset Island from Wind Waker. Like, it's just such
great island.
It's just such a little vibe. Like, I wish that there was more on that island just so I could spend more time there.
Yeah. Unlike Link to the Past, where it's just rainy and your uncle's dead. Like, okay, here goes the game.
Just throw you into it.
Justin, anything come to you?
Yeah. I regret, like, I may want to, like, come back to this next week. Like, the two that are, like, in my brain, and I don't know that these are actually my favorite, but as I said, I didn't prep in advance, are Balum Garden from Final Fantasy VIII, which is the opening hours of the game takes place there, and it's just sort of it's like a school, you know, a cool school where you start the game, and it's a really, really neat location. And then the Citadel from Mass Effect is another very memorable.
Yeah.
Memorable location that you revisit, sort of you return to it throughout the game, and you know, advance a lot of side quests and stuff there, meet a lot of interesting characters.
Mm-hmm. I have a runner-up castle that Justin, I bet you'll agree with, which is the Mario 64 castle.
Oh man,
great place. Yeah. It has a sense of like architecture and like interconnected secret passages, and like you know the layout of that in your brain. And it's like full of surprises. And I think that's like it's just a great game environment. And Banjo-Kazooie did a pretty good job with Gruntilda's Mountain doing that too. But I think Mario Castle.
It's got crazy slides.
Yeah, it's got crazy slides. I saw a really interesting YouTube essay that like I never felt about Mario 64 this way, but they talked about how as a kid they found it really scary and creepy because of how lonely it is. Like Mario's footsteps are really echoey through the castle. Mm-hmm. You never meet anybody else. It's completely empty and
it's loaded with ghosts and rabbits.
Yeah. And just sort of it's got this kind of weird vibe to it that like again, I think I was a little bit too old like when I played that game. But if you played that game when you were like 3 or 4 years younger than me, yeah, I could see it being kind of a creepy place.
Technically, but, you're never alone because Lakitu is right behind you.
Yeah, I love that game has a canon reason for just the camera, like what the camera is.
I had a couple. I have a classic one and then a more modern one. My classic one is Castle Shadowgate. Probably isn't too surprising.
Another castle.
Long time listeners of this show. As a kid, it totally captivated me. I know that it's a point and click game, Shadowgate is, and I know that. You know, not everyone has the patience for that, but just the sense that I had of that I was like exploring this really creepy castle and there's all these cool, you know, monsters everywhere and weird traps and all that. I yearn for like a modern game that's like that where I imagine a game that's as beautiful as like Horizon Forbidden West where I'm free to roam a creepy castle. So things like Resident Evil Village or get a little bit close to that, but it's not.
I didn't know you're a castle boy too.
Yeah,
castle boy. We all are.
Yeah,
good.
He doesn't love a good castle.
Go to some real castles. I miss them. Gotta go to Europe for that or weird parts of America.
There's one in Napa that's a winery, Sam. I forget the name, but we checked it out over Christmas.
It has a dungeon.
Yeah, it's cool.
Didn't that get nailed pretty hard in the last fire?
I was there over Christmas. It was
up and
running. It was good.
Yeah, I got you.
You would hope that the stone would sort of protect it from the fire.
It's kind of the whole point of a castle, right?
Yeah.
And then my modern one is Assassin's Creed Odyssey. I think it would be the Aegean Sea. Just sailing the Aegean Sea. Like, I love the water. I love being out on the water anyway. But a common daydream of mine is just like, imagine like the world back then would have been so beautiful and pristine. There would be no pollution, right? There's not a single bit of plastic in that sea. It'd be, I just can't, it's hard to even like picture how nice the world must have been back then. But in a game like Assassin's Creed, you know, I kind of like feel like I'm back there. It's great. Before we jump into 20 questions, there's a sort of a companion question that, let's see, we got in an email from when Tina was hosting. This is a rejected question. Tina rejected this question. I want everyone to know.
Oh, that's such a harsh way to put it.
I know.
On blast.
I'm just
so excited about it. She sent it back to Damon to use.
Yeah. It comes from Ryan. Ryan says, hey, Omega Cops. I'm a listener of almost 8 years now. I quite enjoy traveling. I miss being able to go to fun places and eat delicious food. That being said, what state or country would you like a video game to be set? And what kind of video game would you like it to be? Have a great day. You know, when I was thinking about this, I was having a hard time coming up with like modern parts of the world that haven't gotten a video game yet.
Yeah.
Hawaii right? needs to get its due. Like, it's such a beautiful place.
Hawaii?
But like, for whatever Hawaii reason, yeah. Like we always like use Florida or something. And it's like, Florida's fine. I lived there for a while. But it's
Contradict you, there's a Pokemon game set in fake Hawaii. And that's the best part about it. But that's what I liked about it. That's very true. I want more of that, you know? I think that's a really good call.
The next GTA should be in Hawaii. It's happening right now.
Yeah, and it's like it's like such a good microcosm of environments. I mean, there's like actually snow, desert, swamp, jungle, beach. Like, it's a video game when you go there. It's unbelievable, especially the big island. Volcano. There's always a boss level, you know? It's a volcano. It's Hawaii is really a like geographical video game. It's so cool.
Yeah, I was so pumped that we finally got, like, I lived in San Francisco for, 15 years, and we finally got that in Watch Dogs 2, which I actually didn't think, I kind of rolled my eyes at that. I'm like, I don't care about that. But then, like, actually being in the game, it actually did feel really cool and special, and seeing what they got right, and then seeing the parts even that they didn't get right. Like, I was a lot more engrossed in that than I expected to be. So, you know, Watch Dogs 2 did do a great job, but I'd obviously be happy to revisit the Bay Area. It's so iconic, and I feel like I would like to see another game go back there. I'm trying to think about something new.
Yeah. So we've gotten San Francisco, Chicago, New York, Tokyo, Pacific Northwest, the Old West with Red Dead Redemption. Assassin's Creed is pretty much covered off on all of Europe, right?
England, Mexico.
And Egypt, which is a great setting. I always like that. So I like not necessarily games set in ancient times. I like ruins. So it's like, I think, you know, games set in, you know, Cambodia's like giant civilization ruins, or there's ruins in Central America around present day St. Louis, which are like, it was like the biggest civilization on Earth at the time. That's a really cool one. And then, of course, South America has like all kinds of cool stuff. Aztecs, Mayans, those civilizations had really neat, you know, ruin. So like, it'd be cool to set games in those places. I like contemporary games where it's like, all right, well, I'm fighting with guns and having fun, but then like you're in this like spooky old, you know, castle or a pyramid or something. It's fun.
This is me showing a lot of bias because I was born and raised and currently live in Colorado. But Colorado is actually like, it's kind of the best state. Like California, I think, is the only one that like gives it a run for me. And we don't see it that often in video games. You kind of see a little bit of it in the original Horizon. But one very interesting, very weird experience that I had was in the original The Last of Us. There's a sequence that takes place in a fictional college called, I think it's Eastern Colorado University. And it does this bizarre thing where it's like its physical location is basically Boulder, where the University of Colorado is. So it's got those really beautiful Flatirons behind it. Its campus is laid out like exactly like Northern Colorado University. And then when you go into the dorms, it's exactly Colorado State University's dorms. So they just did a hodgepodge of those three like main universities from Colorado. And when I'm like playing that level, I get so like, just like I dissociate a little bit. So I'm just like, this is so weird. Like, I've been in these dorms like many times, and then you fall through and you have to fight a giant bloater.
That's great.
That is really good. There's I think I'm probably showing my cultural bias here a little bit, but like, I can't think of too many video games, big AAA games, that give a good representation of China, you know, either ancient China or modern China. And they say I'm potentially showing some cultural bias. It's because Chinese has a really robust game development scene that, like, I just have to confess, sometimes those games don't even come out in English, and I'm sure that they exist, but they haven't really made their way into my awareness. But I would definitely be interested in, like, what a beautiful and diverse and just gigantic part of the earth, right? That, like, would be awesome to be able to, you know, explore in sort of a traditional AAA video game format.
Dynasty Warriors?
Yeah.
Probably. Maybe a better game set in China?
Sure. Are there more Dynasty Warriors games than there are Sonic games?
Apparently not, according to Mike in Toronto.
if you want to play a game set entirely in Iceland, but not actually, play Death Stranding, because every environment is Iceland.
That was going to be my joke. I just wasn't fast enough.
Wait, is it actually in Iceland?
No. It just looks exactly like Iceland. I think they actually shot footage there, right? Yeah.
Because it's supposed to kind of be the U.S., right?
But yeah, that's what's funny. It's like Horizon, where it's like, we talked about this on a different episode, but it's like contracted United States. Mm-hmm, but but like the post-apocalyptic version of the United States turns out it's just Iceland. Moss-covered rocks, rock-covered rocks, and snow-covered rocks. That's Iceland.
Well, rock-covered rocks, I think that's just like a mountain.
Yes, and there's a lot of those. You have to walk over them.
Sam, that reminds me, and I may have mentioned this before, my son is really into like lava right now and volcanoes.
Yeah. And so missed that great eruption in Iceland that you could walk up to. And I did too.
I'll pull up, if I search like volcano 4K on YouTube, all the volcanoes are in Iceland, apparently.
Yeah. Well, last summer, there was a very safe, slow eruption that everybody was walking to. The New Yorker did a really amazing article on it. And I was there during that time, but depending on what was happening each day, you couldn't access it. Like there was actually like a 6-hour hike, and then it became like a 1-hour hike. And then it was back to like an 8-hour hike because of actual lava rivers, right? Because it cut off places to go. But one night we were walking and it was like, you know, the sun is up all night there. So it's like jet lag, walking at like 1 a.m., like just on like a stroll. And I look from the top of this hill towards that volcano, and it looks exactly like Peter Jackson's. This is from Reykjavik.
It looks like Mordor, right?
It looks like Mordor. There's a line
of mountains. That's exactly what I said.
A peak, and then like spewing orange in the sky. You can see it rising and falling, and like an actual like giant. This is, you know, 15 miles away or something too, and it's cartoonish. It's unbelievable. You know, and just sitting there like in a green field, people are playing soccer at midnight or whatever next to you. And there's like this thing in the distance. It was crazy.
Yeah. But just last night, we pulled up this Icelandic volcano video and I said that exact same thing. This looks like Mordor. And I realized Kingo has no idea what Mordor is yet.
Yeah. But I bet Peter Jackson has that same experience in New Zealand. And they probably, I mean, it's all faked in the movies. But, you know, if you see that in real life and like, think what a volcano looks like. It's like it's like a cartoon. It's like, it looks like exactly like it should. It's great. Mm-hmm.
And that brings us to Video Game 20 Questions. Our suggestion this week comes from Carlos in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Ooh. Let the questioning begin.
What kind of games they playing over in Pennsylvania?
Colin, do you remember what the game was last time you were on?
Yeah, it was Wii Fit, and we got it really quickly.
How do you just? I don't even remember what the game was last week.
Oh, actually, can I do something? Because I messed up the way I phrased a question last time. And it was really stupid. So I want to re-ask the question right this time.
Okay.
Was this game originally released on a cartridge?
No.
Okay. Oh, is it Wii Fit? We're done.
Remember, if you guess wrong, you lose.
All right.
If you guess wrong,
it's been a great episode, everybody.
Okay, well, was this game originally released? I mean, was it worth asking if it's on a CD? Is it worth clarifying that, or do we assume
it could be or it could be like just download only type thing?
We could also do a year, and then we might get that answer based on that.
Yeah, I was this game originally released on a CD?
No.
Or
no.
Well, damn it. I hope Damon didn't mean
I'm interpreting
take
that. As like just a disc.
DVD optical medium was the intent.
CD is a generalized term because it's a compact disc, right?
Yeah,
good point.
As opposed to a giant disc,
laser disc,
and the actual compact discs were GameCube games.
Yeah, the compactest of all.
Yeah,
a CCD.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not on a disc or cartridge, is what you're saying?
Yeah,
or it wasn't originally.
Was this originally released in arcade?
Yes.
Okay.
Cool.
Pre-1983?
No.
Was it released in the 90s?
Yes. That's 5.
Is it a fighting game?
Yes.
Oh, is it Street Fighter 2? Okay, well, we know it's a fighting game. Was it made by Capcom?
Yes.
Oh, is it in the Street Fighter series?
Yes.
Okay.
not Street well, Fighter what? 1, that came up before the 90s.
Street Fighter 2, Street Fighter Alpha, or Alpha 2. I think Street Fighter 3 was even probably still 90s. Turbo and Championship Edition were console only. They weren't in the PC. I mean, what was this, the second game in a series?
Yes.
Is Street Fighter 2?
That's 10. Yes, Street Fighter 2.
Holy crap.
Wow. I'm so glad it wasn't Street Fighter Alpha 2. I would have been so mad.
Just vanilla Street Fighter 2. Nicely done.
Did they have those like extra editions in arcades, or was it usually just the original number?
Yeah, no. Street Fighter 2, the World Warrior was the first one. And then they did Street Fighter 2. I believe in the arcade version, the first one that was out was Champion Edition. And that has the boss characters in it. And lots of people played that one.
And I think those were on console only.
No, there's arcade boards. Yeah, they did those with it. And you saw that. And then there's the Rainbow games, which are legs where they messed with all that stuff.
Well, I know the Turbo Edition, I don't know if this was ever officially supported by Capcom, but those started as like coin-op operators modifying their game so that it would run turbo speed at like the request of, you know, they were doing that on behalf of their players. And then I don't know if Capcom ever, you know, officially supported that or not.
That's why Ms. Pac-Man exists, is for modifying Pac-Man.
Yeah.
Being licensed. And Fast Ms. Pac-Man is also a modification. And it's very good and basically the definitive version. If you play slow, it's not even fun.
Wasn't it a bunch of like MIT students who were like illegally doing that, and then they got sued, and then I think they ended up going to work for Atari or something like that?
Midway in the United States.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. And in fact, there's a great GDC talk by one of the speakers, which must have just happened because I got like one of those weird like photo reminders on your phone with him in a picture. Mm-hmm. He was at IGN. Really, really cool story behind that, though. It was called Crazy Auto, and it had a little walking version of Pac-Man, like with legs. And that was like, but they changed up the mazes, and you know, that was the innovations. And then they did a whole branding as Ms. Pac-Man, which is brilliant. And completely unacknowledged by Namco now.
Yep.
Street Fighter 2 completely changed arcade competition from high score chasing to just trying to beat your other human opponent.
Yep.
Right.
Because Street Fighter 1, wasn't it like literally just Ryu and Ken or something like that?
Yes. It's just, it's just like, I think those are the options. And then the original version of that arcade cabinet was the one with big buttons that you hit. And
yeah,
a low punch was a light hit and a hard punch was a high hit. And I have never seen one of those in person. It's even hard to find pictures of them.
Seems like it would break so easily. Yeah.
The Street Fighter 2, Damon, so what a revolution in making money for an arcade game, right? If someone was really good, they could sit there and stay. And even if you weren't really good, then it felt crappy because like your game was over in 60 seconds. But like paying a quarter to match up against somebody else is just brilliant. Like then nobody, I mean, I'm sure you still feel bad if you lose, but like they could make 10 times as much money without it feeling gross and bad to the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't have any evidence to this, but Street Fighter 2, I would guess is probably the biggest arcade phenomenon that would have happened since Pac-Man.
Yeah. I think it was Pac-Man to that. And Ms. Pac-Man's the highest selling arcade game of all time. And that was in the biggest year for arcades, 82. So Pac-Man fever.
And
was
I can't
real.
Imagine anything being bigger after Street Fighter, like maybe like some Dance Dance Revolution type of
DDR thing. Did really well. I mean, it's cool and it was culturally pervasive for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, definitely a top five arcade phenomenon.
We went to an arcade on our trip to Chicago, and all the games are mobile games now.
Oh, yeah, Flappy Bird, weird, right?
Flappy Bird and Doodle God,
Fruit Ninja.
Yeah,
you just play them on an arcade.
And it's a big vertical screen too, so it looks like a giant version of a mobile game. Like it was easy to port, kind of, and you kind of sit in front of it or stand in front of it, and it's like a big screen. If you there's that type of game, and there's also like other big screen things. There's like a big screen Galaga and a big screen.
I like those. Yeah, I like the big screen. The big screen Galaga is pretty good.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for your suggestion, Carlos in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Listeners and viewers, if you have your own suggestions for Video Game 20 questions, email them to me at the email address gamescoop@ign.com. And that's all the scoops that we have for you this week. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Justin. Thank you, Colin. Always a pleasure having you on. Thank you to Alan working behind the scenes to make this episode possible. My name is Damon. This is IGN Gamescoop. We're out.
Hello, dear stranger. I'd like to introduce you to something new, or perhaps something very, very old. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine is a horror fantasy medical mystery following the titular monk turned traveling medical investigator. Follow Radolf as he navigates a nightmare world in which viruses are gods and the human race are not their favored children. Steeped in history and an aesthetic that can only be described as a combination of occult academia and laboratory Judaica, the Heresies of Radolf Burntwine have been described as Umberto Eco meets H.P. Lovecraft. For more information, check out the Patreon at thorb.info. But take care, dear stranger, for some truths are best left unknown.